Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Naked Politics. Today is Friday the 13th, so happy Friday the 13th. As we speak, newly elected members of Congress are here in Washington for the first weekend of freshman orientation, even though we don't know the results yet from some of the tighter races, including my own old district, California 25, which is currently separated by, I think, 100 votes. So we're still really hoping for the best with that. Returning members are arriving actually later this weekend to go back into the lame duck session next week. And between now and when all the members are sworn into the 117th Congress in the very beginning of January, both Democrats and Republicans need to figure out their new caucus dynamics, including new members, electing new members of House leadership. That includes the Speaker, that includes the leaders of the majority and the minority, everything like that. So what happens over the next 6 weeks is going to determine who the key players are for the next 2 years, committee chairs, you know, who the big ones are going to be in the new freshman class, and so on and so forth. When I came 2 years ago, this as a freshman, this was a total blur. And I have to say it was a real wake-up call in terms of, you know, how power is gained and traded in Washington. And until I was here, I actually really knew nothing about this process. I didn't know anything about what the leadership positions were, aside from obviously the speaker. I didn't know anything about the time frame. I didn't even know that there was like an actual constitutional date that we got sworn in as members of Congress. That is not inauguration and is not inauguration day. It was January 3rd. But I wanted to bring in somebody who can help walk, you know, you all, well, all of us through what's happening right now. Somebody who's been through this as a reporter, through a whole lot of transitions in Congress. His name is Jake Sherman. He's the senior writer for Politico and the co-author of Politico's Playbook, which is the nation's leading political newsletter. He's doing that until the end of the year when he's moving on to bigger and better things, which he won't tell us what he's doing yet. But he's also a contributor to NBC News and MSNBC. He wrote the New York Times bestseller, The Hill to Die On, and he's got a great snarky Twitter feed. So I hope you enjoyed this conversation as much as I did. It gives you lots of insight into, you know, inside the Beltway right now. So enjoy. All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us. So Jake, tell us, how many new Congresses have you reported on? How long have you been here? How long have you been doing this?
I'm ashamed to admit. So I started in 2009. So I covered the beginning of 2010, 12, 14, 16, 18. And now, so this is my sixth.
Okay, cool. You've been through the dynamics. And I think that this, I wanted to have you join us because this 6 week period, I think, is fascinating. I had no idea what to expect. All these freshmen are coming into DC, like wide eyed and what is the saying? Wide eyed and bushy tailed.
Bright eyed and bushy tailed. Yeah.
Although I'm not sure that that's quite the vibe this time. Either way, you know, you're kind of thrown into the middle of it and you have no idea what's really going on. And I kind of wish that I had had somebody like you to talk to prior to it happening last time around. So why don't you just kind of tell us what this time period's like for people outside of DC? Like, walk us through what's happening now, what has to happen between now and January when the new Congress is sworn in.
Yeah, and since you've been through this, you could jump in and tell me where I'm wrong. Thank you. So a few things. I'll kind of take every part of that question. So these first, I guess, 6 weeks, and even I would actually extend it into January, right? Because everyone's kind of getting set up through January. But I mean, members of Congress come in town, they learn about what it's like to be a member of Congress, I guess, and all the responsibilities there within. And I'm assuming, Katie, since you've been through this, it's shell shock, right? I mean, you're hearing a lot of things for the first time, and you're like, and somebody like you and like a lot of people have not been in obviously federal office before, but many people haven't been in local office, right? Or some people haven't been in local office. And so you have to hire a staff and a chief of staff and a communications director and all those things. But the more interesting thing, and you definitely went through this by dint of when you came in, but you're immediately thrown into leadership elections, right? Because you have to figure out who you're, and you were in leadership, so that was a little bit different. But you have to, you're kind of thrown into the mix of Nancy Pelosi asking for your vote, and whatever you think of Nancy Pelosi, not you specifically, whatever one thinks of Nancy Pelosi, she is the most, probably the most consequential legislator of our lifetime. And mm-hmm. not only our shared lifetime, because you and I are around the same age, but our, like, the last 100 years, probably. I mean, yeah. among, you'd have to put her, if not at the top, definitely toward the top.
Yeah.
So she's there asking you for your vote. And a lot of people have made promises on the campaign trail or at different other times throughout their political life that they wouldn't vote for Nancy Pelosi, right? Because she's a lightning rod and she is controversial in some swing districts. And rightly or wrongly, I'm not going to make that judgment. She's definitely a divisive figure to some in some places in America. So you're kind of balancing all of these crazy dynamics. Also, the rubber meets the road on the promises that you made, I think, during your campaign, right? I mean, a lot of people say they're going to come in and pass Bill X, Y, and Z, but when they get to Congress, they realize, and you probably realize this too, that you're not able to pass anything like right off the bat, right?
Nope.
You're day one of, whether if you're a Republican and you say day one, I'm going to repeal and replace Obamacare, or if you're a Democrat and say day one, I'm going to, you know, whatever, you're not going to do that. And 90% of your time at the front end and throughout your time in Congress is setting up an operation that deals with like a variety of constituent services and local and parochial and federal issues and figuring out where you fit in this crazy mosaic of an institution where many people have been there for 30 years plus or 20 years plus and already have a rhythm and a vibe. So
totally.
What did I miss? I mean, that sounds like a pretty,
yeah.
So what else did you find?
Yeah. Well, so there's the freshmen.
I'm gonna turn the tables on you.
Yeah,
times,
totally. So. Well, so you've got the freshmen who are doing orientation on both parties. Like, so there's a hotel where all of the new members of Congress are, and they're thrown in together. You've got the most progressive members, I think, that we've seen, right, that have ousted incumbents. You've also got the QAnon people, right?
And, right.
And they're all together in a building learning about, you know, like basics. You know, yeah, really basics, but it's like very hard to retain any of that information. You're trying to figure out who's who, and so there's that piece. Meanwhile, literally at your hotel rooms, you are getting sent like goodie bags from all the people who are running for leadership positions, and that was the thing that I was most shocked by. Like, I remember getting like just swag and candy and random stuff that just kept showing up at your door. And you're like, who's this from and why? And suddenly you see it's like somebody who's running for, you know, chair of a committee that you didn't even know existed when you were out on the outside. And, or these other leadership positions. Like, I had no idea what the DPCC was before the, and now I'm going to.
Policy committee. Yep.
Yeah, Policy and Communications Committee.
Right.
And there's like three different positions for that. And I feel like every new Congress, they kind of create some new leadership positions too.
They do.
So you've got that. You've got the freshmen, you've got the leadership stuff, and then you've got the actual lame duck of whatever has to happen legislatively for the members who in some cases have lost or are retiring. And this is the last 6 weeks. Like, I remember last time, you know, Joe Crowley had lost but he was the chair of the Democratic caucus. He was a big deal. So he was like running meetings and stuff like that. Meanwhile, he had lost. AOC was in some of those things. It was very awkward. He sang a song.
As he tends to do. Can I say one more thing while I have it fresh in mind? Like, this time we're in the middle, or the Democrats are in the middle of like a really crazy moment, right? Mm-hmm. Because the Pelosi had said before the election that she was going to win seats. Democrats were going to add to their ranks, and they hadn't, and they didn't, rather. And I just think Democrats are trying to figure out what that means, right? Like, what are they supposed to make of that, totally, that dynamic? And with kind of the, I don't think, and maybe we'll get this, maybe we won't, I don't think Nancy Pelosi is going to lose. I think she's going to be the speaker next Congress. But I do think there are a bunch of people who have questions about her and about how long she's been atop the caucus and speaker since 2006 on and off. And I think these will fuel some of those questions, complaints, gripes. And again, I'm not suggesting she's done anything wrong specifically. In fact, she was asked at a press conference that I was just at whether she takes any responsibility for losing seats. And she said, I take credit for keeping the House, or winning the House and keeping the House.
I saw your tweet about that. And I was like, that is a very Nancy response.
Yeah, it is. And I just kind of wonder, like, there are people who are like, well, wait a second. Joe Biden won and we couldn't knock off Republicans in a year where, you know, we're in the middle of, you know, 250,000 people dead and economy shut down and all this stuff. So I think there's some of that that people have to address. And, you know, and Republicans are at least somewhat ascendant at the moment on Capitol Hill, right? They kept their majority in the Senate, most likely, unless something happens in Georgia, which we don't know. I guess as of now, it looks like they're going to have the majority, or they haven't lost the majority. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
And Republicans ushered in, you know, not a single Republican incumbent lost.
Yeah. I mean,
that's crazy. And 26 new women, I think, are coming to Congress, Republican women. Obviously, there's a far more Democratic women. But they made strides, and I think people recognize that and want answers to why.
Yep. Yeah. So let's talk about that, right? You're already seeing kind of on Twitter and in the media this tension between progressives and moderates, and that was certainly played up and existed last time too, you know, 2 years ago.
Yep.
Including where you had people expecting that both on the progressive side with, you know, AOC and the others, that they weren't going to support Nancy Pelosi. And then you had the ones who literally promised it on the campaign trail that they wouldn't. So now it's a narrower majority. She's got less room for people to not, you know, to not support her. But there doesn't seem to be a real challenge to her for speaker, right?
There doesn't. I mean, there's no one who's announced they're running, and to knock off someone like Pelosi, you have to have an operation. So like I've been, you know, vocally skeptical of people who say we need a new leadership or we need new blood. Like, if you need new blood, then put together an operation and run to beat somebody. I mean, you can't beat somebody with nobody. And listen, there's no doubt that people think Pelosi's been there for too long, but there is nobody right now who could beat her. And maybe we should talk about this. There's two stages of these elections, right? There's the caucus vote, where the candidate for speaker has to go in front of the Democratic members and win a majority of the members. In this case, it'll probably be something like 110, I'd guess, because it'll be probably 220 or so Democrats. And then on the House floor, the speaker candidate has to get 218, which is really, that's where it gets tricky for her. Although I really, and I've been meaning to explore this in some way, shape or form, but how could they have a speaker vote in person this time around? I just don't think. I think people are going to have to vote by proxy. And I wonder how that changes the dynamics for Pelosi.
Well, all of it, right? Like so much of this stuff is done in person. So much of the, you know, meeting people and talking to them. And I mean, that's politics, right? So, totally. You know, this whole last year, it hasn't been normal. And so, you know, you're talking, I'm even thinking about the swearing in that's supposed to happen January 3rd. You're supposed to have everybody there. I mean, what are they going to do? I don't think, has anyone said there's not?
No, they've not. I mean, I assume it'll mostly be remote or people will come in waves. But remember, there's no, you know, the testing capacity, Congress's testing capacity for COVID is relatively limited. I think it's totally ridiculous. And luckily I'm in a room alone right now. So I don't have, I'm not at risk of being infected, I suppose, but I have my mask at hand. I just think that, I don't know how Congress is going to do any of this. And listen, this is going to get into, and I hope we could touch on this a little bit because it's important, which is Joe Biden has an incredibly, incredibly ambitious legislative agenda, which Nancy Pelosi is going to have to shepherd in some way, shape or form. And House Democrats are going to have to reckon with in this new political universe. And I'm very interested to see how all of that shakes out.
Well, especially with a potentially Republican Senate still. And that's, you know, that's one of the things I was going to ask you is like, okay, so is there, to me, there are a couple of things that just stand out as possible and, you know, necessary. I mean, the first is COVID relief, right? Like we were supposed to have gotten COVID relief forever ago. Do you see anything happening with that between now and January?
I don't, and I'll tell you why. Well, I don't want to say I don't. I want to say I think it's tough because Nancy Pelosi has said she is in the same place she was before the election, which is she wants a multi-trillion dollar COVID package with state and local funding and enhanced unemployment benefits and all of the things that she has been pushing for, because she believes, and she's right on this count, that the situation is dire, right? In New York, they just announced, I mean, minutes ago, that we're going to shut down schools again come next week. I mean, places are struggling and all across the country, not only in big cities. So Pelosi's view is we need to do what we need to do, and we need to swallow it, and we need to own it, and we need to swallow a bitter pill and like do what's necessary. That's number one. Number two, Mitch McConnell has said he wants a targeted package of about $500 billion, $500 to $800 billion, and wants it to include, you know, not all the things that Pelosi wants. She wants he wants it to include some, you know, targeted packages for hospitals and liability reform for companies and schools and things of that nature. So their base case, both of them want a COVID relief bill. Where they differ, where they differentiate, where they split is the size and scope and contents of it. Now, I mean, the question for me is, if you want, like, legislating is the art of the possible, right? So the possible here is the lowest common denominator, which is McConnell's bill. And the question is, can they work off of that basis? Now, the reason they didn't get it last time, in my estimation, is because they were working with the White House, which is just incompetent legislatively, no matter what you think of the president, but just completely incompetent. And Steven Mnuchin is, you know, not, he's might've cut some deals maybe on Wall Street or a couple in DC, but he's not very, very, wasn't very skilled at it this time around.
Right.
But can they make something out of a small bill? And then can Pelosi say in January, we're going to take another bite at the apple when, right, when Joe Biden's in office? I think that's tough, but I think it's doable. So,
yeah. Well, that's what I was going to say, is that often, you know, where you run into problems with the whole concept of compromise is that, you know, there's this very strong sense, and especially when you, So Nancy Pelosi's job and all of leadership's job is to navigate an entire caucus that ranges from people who are these hardcore blue dogs that basically are Republicans sometimes. I mean, I probably shouldn't say that, but some of them are. I mean, Colin Peterson, who lost this time, like he pretty much voted with Republicans on almost everything. And you know, I have some strong feelings about some of the other blue dogs, but then you've got the progressives that have clearly been gaining in, you know, pretty substantial ways, and that definitely have the hearts and minds of a lot of people in, you know, in terms of the Democratic donor base, the activist base, et cetera. And so if you as leadership kind of concede and give in, as people see it, to, you know, Mitch McConnell's plan, then you have no bargaining chip left, right? Like people have gotten some relief. And so what's the trade to be able to get them to go back to the table and give more later? And there's, you know, especially when Republicans in the Senate don't actually, like, they don't really want to move things. They're fine with being the obstructionist party right now.
I don't know. I'm not sure if that'll change, though.
I was wondering that too.
I haven't fully wrapped my head around this yet, but I do think that McConnell has some incentive to get some stuff done with the map that he has in 2022. But you're right. I mean, listen, if Pelosi doesn't, her theory is if she doesn't do something big now, when is she going to do it? But I mean, she said today in a news conference that her leverage increases and her power increases when she has a Democrat in the White House, no matter that, doesn't really matter that she lost seats and she doesn't have the Senate as she had anticipated and hoped. Now, I mean, listen, I do have views on, I have, you know, I what I like to say to people is I'm not biased on policy or politics, but I am biased on how people use power and what the best way to use power is. And I do think that, and I was just telling this to one of your former colleagues, who is a, I don't want to say too much, but somebody who wanted a COVID deal and was wondering, a Democrat, and was wondering how they would get Pelosi to, how to move Pelosi. And I said to this person, like, you need to starve her of what she needs, whatever mm-hmm. that is, if it's a vote mm-hmm. on a government funding bill, if it's a vote on something else, like you need to make it clear that unless she gives you what she want, what you want, she's not going to get something that she wants, and you need to get 10 people to join along with you. That's how power works. So let me yep. extend that a little bit. If McConnell is going to want something at some point mm-hmm. from Pelosi and is going to need something at some point. So I know I'm oversimplifying here, but I'm trying to make the point that like everyone has pressure points, right?
Yeah.
Everyone has leverage points, and you have to be able to know what they are and take advantage of them.
Totally. Yeah. And I mean, I think that was one of the things that, you know, could have been potentially used more by either the more vulnerable Democrats this past time or the progressives. Like when push came to shove, you know, no one really voted against, no one really wanted to separate from the caucus as a whole to kind of block anything. You saw that a little bit with some of the, I guess I'm trying to remember what it even was, with some of the immigration mm-hmm. relief stuff. Mm-hmm. But there was, you know, it's a big political risk to go against the caucus, and you kind of know that there will probably be some payback at some point, right?
But this is my ultimate question though about people like AOC and like progressives in Congress overall. Like, there's no question. There's an argument I have with people all the time. There's no question that the base of the party around the country, the base, not necessarily people in you know, in swing districts and things right. like that, but the base of the party is progressive and yeah. looks at somebody like AOC and is like, why aren't we punching people in the face like she is?
Yep.
Like, why are we not her? And yeah. I don't deny that she is probably one of the most skilled politicians of your and my generation. And I say
she
that
really is.
Maybe
yeah.
people from 25 to 45 or something yep. like that, right? Or something like that. But will that power translate into something in the Capitol? Can mm-hmm. she get things done?
Yep.
And what this is like a dynamic I explored in my book a little bit when it came to Jim Jordan and Mark Meadows and the Freedom Caucus, right? They were in the minority and they were in the House majority, but their viewpoint was the minority of the House Republicans, right? It was 20 people. But they realized if they got 20 people to have the same opinion at all times, then they could sway things. So will Democrats, is there any Democrat with any stones to do something like that? Mm-hmm. And I don't know that there is. And I'm not saying it's good or bad, but like, we know that the Senate is an institution where one person makes a difference. We know the House is an institution where you need a union, right? You need a coalition. Mm-hmm. It's so funny because like Democrats are all about collective bargaining and union rights and yep. the power of collective workers banding together to get things done. Well, if you're a member of the House Democratic rank and file and you disagree with your leadership, find 10 friends and tell Nancy Pelosi what you want and you'll get it.
Yeah. And some of that happens right behind the scenes and it gets worked into a bigger bill or whatever. But yeah, it's, you know, taking that sort of blockade stance is something that kind of goes against a lot of what Democrats believe in.
But you concede it's a good strategic move, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. But it's also, it is the strategic move. It's your only strategic move. If you want to kind of do something that is different from, I mean, let's be real. Leadership defines what's happening, right? Like,
totally.
And when we say leadership, it's really Nancy and Steny and, you know, mostly Nancy.
Nancy, correct.
Yeah. And then, you know, that means that if you want something different, like it is incredibly hard to get that done, especially because like, it's pretty easy to find 20 people who agree with you. At least I found this. What's harder is to find 20 people who are going to stick to that and take the political consequences that could come from it when, you know, shit hits the fan.
And also, by the way, it's difficult to, and Nancy Pelosi's specialty, as we saw when your class came into Congress, is peeling people away from the yep. crowd, right? Yep. Is getting people, getting individuals,
one
sanding them down. People wonder what Pelosi's like skill is. And it's actually, I mean, I'm not saying it's easy, but it's actually easy to understand, right? She's
oh, yeah.
really good at wearing people down. Like yep. she's just really good at that.
Yeah, she's she figures out what people need, what their pressure points are on an individual basis. And she's got a lot of, you know, she's got every single chairman, every single, you know, person with any kind of clout in the caucus who's also working for her. And, yeah. you know, if you, you know, you feel it as a more junior, even as a more senior member, I think that, yeah. you know, everyone knew, like you, if you went away from, and I'm not saying that that's, I mean, that is her job, right? Like that is the job of leadership as far totally. As I'm concerned, but it also means that, you know, trying to make something happen that's outside of that is really difficult because like, let's just say you have 20 people or 10 people enough to block something from happening, then you are the ones, you were directly the one. And the problem solvers, I think, have done this a few times, did it a few times. And oh man.
Yeah. yeah. I don't think I'm down and I've been vocally down on the problem solvers for a long time.
Me too.
I don't think they solve problems.
They don't solve problems. And they make problems, but they, right. but they've done that, right? Like they've held things up because they've, you know, they've had enough people to sort of, I don't know, stand in one direction.
You know, I've had a theory of the case that pisses progressives off and has for a long time, and pisses Republicans off too, which is there's very little difference strategically between Nancy Pelosi and Mitch McConnell. They both kind of pick a distance in the a spot in the horizon and say to themselves, to their teams, like, that's where we're going. I don't know what the route is, but like, that's where we're going and we're going to get there someday, yeah. you know? And yeah. like, I don't know however long it takes, I don't know, but like, we're going to get there.
Yeah. And when you're thinking in terms of decades or your entire lifetime, like you can do that.
yeah. Well, I think about healthcare reform in 2009, 2010, like it took her a year and she just knew that like, there would be like fires that she had to put out that she really had to like, work through, put out, move people aside, and like, and she just did it, and she didn't care about like the momentary political pressures, and that's what makes her really good.
Yeah, absolutely. So, how do you see this playing out? Do you think that there's enough fresh kind of, I don't know, sentiment in some way, whether it's from the more moderate side or the more progressive side, that's going to sort of change that dynamic and push things one way or another?
I don't know. I think a lot of Democrats are pissed off that they didn't get COVID relief last time. Like, I think people blame Pelosi privately, not on the record, but blame Pelosi for not taking the small package that she could have got from Mnuchin. And they think that it was short-sighted and she was holding out for something that she was never going to get. I think that they're going to have to listen. I think there's going to be a lot of hope and a lot of energy when Joe Biden takes the White House, because I think, you know, I just think that like people are tired of the Trump era, right? I just think they are. I think that even small legislative victories will be kind of refreshing for a lot of Democrats and even Republicans. But I mean, listen, I don't know. I think that look at like this shit show. I'm allowed to say that, right?
For sure.
Cool. I mean, I figured.
Yes.
I figured. Listen, like, look at the shit that's playing out in public right now between AOC and Connor Lamb. And yeah. I mean, these aren't like Pelosi likes to say, you know, we have a really dynamic caucus and it's great and we have a variety of opinions. Like, that's not what's happening here. Like, what's happening here is a fundamental disagreement about what the party is and what the party should represent and put in public, right? Like, AOC's like, no, we need to stop fracking and like that should be the centerpiece of our agenda. And Connor Lamb's like, actually, no, we can't do that because I need to win my district. And like, I've been thinking about this a lot recently. When I started covering Congress in 2009, the Democratic Party was like Ohio, the Midwest, Southwestern Virginia, you know, like had a big presence in these districts that are now all red. Now the party is mostly coastal, mostly big cities and suburbs. And not that there's anything wrong like with that. I grew up in a suburb and I live in a city now. So, yeah. But I don't know if you can make a majority of AOCs and you know I don't know and some other suburban and urban districts. I think you need to be able to attract, you know, more rural and ex-urban districts, and Connor Lamb is kind of case in point. So
yeah, I think that's problems. I think that you are going to see that kind of trending, because people will, you know, the Republicans, for better or for worse, have well, actually, it doesn't even matter if it's for better or for worse. It just is, have you know, effectively used what AOC and others, you know, like her are championing, right? Against everybody else. And even if that's not what you believe at all, if that's not what you've espoused, like that just is what is on the ads, right? Like my negative ads were already like in 2018, after she just won her primary, she was being used in attack ads against Democrats. And this time, you know, she was even more than Pelosi. And that's,
you know, I was the other day at a press conference, John Thune said the Pelosi Schumer AOC agenda. I mean, never has a sophomore member of Congress taken a, and you know what the thing is, like the interesting thing about this kind of dust up in the, intra-party dust up is that Connor Lamb seems to like have no respect for the electorate that elected AOC, right? Yeah. He said you won in a low turnout Democratic primary because you caught an incumbent sleeping, basically is what he said. He didn't say those words, but I mean, all true. She did win in a low turnout primary. That doesn't take away from how skilled of a politician she is and communicator. But I mean, these are problems that will impact governing, because no matter what Nancy Pelosi says, AOC is going to get 50,000 times more eyeballs than Nancy Pelosi is. And I know
definitely Connor Lamb, right? Like, I mean,
for sure. Right. I mean, so that's kind of, anyway, that's,
well,
that's
and what I think we're missing is the Democratic caucus is there are not a lot of people who were able to bridge that gap between progressives and moderates. And that was, I know that was a role that I played among the freshmen last time around. And I was, you know, that was literally kind of my job as the freshman representative, was to try and kind of quell things that were happening on both sides. And I happened to be able to sort of be more progressive in my district, at least a bit than, you know, even though it was a purple one. And I just, there's not a lot of people like that, especially that want to take on that job. It's a hard job. And so I'm interested in seeing if that plays out, but you know, I consider myself friends with AOC and a lot of, you know, the other members.
Yeah.
She was telling me, she's like, there are like no frontliners who have even had a conversation with her about this stuff. Like it gets aired out in public because people don't talk about it in private. Like they don't go and actually have these talks with, you know, with how people can be allies. And I think that that's fair. Like there was from day one, there was this like, she's the enemy. She's, and I'm saying she, it's not just her obviously, but it's like, you know, there's this risk, like this lightning rod kind of like, we can't go anywhere near that. You don't even want your picture taken near her. And one thing that I think people, you know, we talk about crossing the aisle. There is a literal aisle in, you know, that I don't think a lot of people outside of DC know about, but there's a literal aisle. And the more moderate people or the blue dogs hang out with the Republicans in the center aisle, and the literally the further left you get, the further, you know, the more progressive, more liberal, and they don't necessarily mingle much. And I think that's a real problem. But
I mean, that's interesting. I mean, I don't know. I do find it interesting that there's so little conversation with AOC among kind of frontliners and stuff. I mean, I think part of it is probably that, so just that association with her, that would be that people, and you're right, right? She's going to appear in a campaign ad if you have a picture with her, if you have any association with her, and that's just a reality of it. But she does have a way, and I think a lot of, I would say this, I'd say the DCCC is antiquated, and the campaign apparatuses that have run party politics for a long time are antiquated, and people like AOC or you and, you know, our kind of generation understands the world of communicating better than a lot of other people who are political professionals in a lot of ways, right? I think that's a reality, but I mean, I'm very interested to see how these dynamics play themselves out in the coming weeks and months. It'll be fascinating.
So real quick, let's go back to the DCCC for those who don't know, the DCCC is the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. It's the arm that is basically responsible for protecting the majority or gaining the majority, depending on what's happening. And in this time, you know, the thought was that you were going to protect your incumbents and that you were going to expand the map, and it didn't play out. Sherry Bustos was the head of the DCCC this time. She announced that she's not running. She stepped effectively stepped down the other day. The only person I know of so far is Tony Cardenas, who's running. Are there others that...
I think Sean Patrick Maloney's also running. And he would be the first, gay head of the DCCC. And I think he is, listen, he has a purple-ish district in the suburbs of New York. He wrote the autopsy in 2016 that was summarily ignored about how the DCCC fucked up that cycle. and listen, I'm of the opinion that these committees are increasingly useless. And you know, if I were and I'm not because I'm a reporter, but just, you know, my book involved a lot of reporting at the DCCC in 2016 to 2018. And that DCCC actually, in my estimation, did a really good job, led by Ben Ray Lujan and some other people in that universe. But the DCCC should basically be like a consulting firm to help campaigns help people like frontliners get their campaigns in order and leave all the fundraising and messaging to outside groups and super PACs, because that's where it mostly is anyway. Like, that should be a member services organization and not running races, in my view. I just think that would be a bit better served. It would have better purpose that way. And by the way, some of this progressive angst spills over to the DCCC, because the DCCC says it won't contract with people who try to knock off incumbents.
Yeah, I understand. That might have to change. I don't know. I thought that policy was pretty limiting, but.
But I mean, listen, what were your dues at the DCCC? A couple hundred grand?
No, I didn't. So I didn't have them because I was a frontliner, even though I was in leadership. But yeah, no, if I paid the equivalent dues for being in leadership, then yeah, it would have been a few hundred grand.
If you're paying 200 grand to an organization that then does business with people that are trying to knock off your colleagues, I mean,
I get it. Yeah.
Not a great look.
Because people don't pay their dues anyway. Like,
right.
But so really quick, I wanted to mention, you know, we're hearing a lot now in terms of the autopsy of what happened, that we lost a lot of ground with Latinos in, you know, both the presidential and on the, you know, on the congressional side in the House races. And I think, you know, my district we're going to see that. Right now it's like 100 votes separating whether, you know, Christy Smith gets it or Mike Garcia. But I won by 9 in 2018. And that was a huge push among Latinos. Like, that was a massive part of my coalition in my district. And Tony Cardenas is my neighbor. He's literally the district right below. And, I think that there's going to be a big argument in his case that, you know, we, even in these swing districts, the suburbs, like, if you actually organize Latinos, then you're gonna do a lot better. But there are two, you know, we talk about the progressives not really using it and the Blue Dogs not really using it, that whole stopping power thing, right? But there are two groups that do use it, and that's the CBC and the CHC, the Congressional Black Caucus and the Congressional Hispanic Caucus. And there have been plenty of things that did not move or changed because, you know, the CHC was not going to, you know, except a deal that didn't include X, Y, and Z. And I think that we're probably going to see even more of that because Latino members are saying, like, we missed the boat big time here. And I just think that that's a
I don't know why. I mean, and this is going to sound naive, but I haven't really heard a good reason why Democrats have been in such bad shape. We're in such bad shape with Latinos this time around. Like, I don't know I haven't heard a good explanation for this yet. And the numbers are astounding when you look at them, kind of sum of everything.
I mean, right? I'll tell you my theory is that, you know, Democrats basically completely abandoned door-to-door knocking because of COVID.
Right.
And, I've said from the very beginning, that's a bad move. And, you know, if you can go to the grocery store, if we're saying people can go out with masks and stay social distance, you surely can do that at a door. You can wear a mask and you can step back. You don't want to get in people's space anyway. By the way,
Republicans did it, right?
They did a ton.
The Congressional Leadership Fund, which is the House Republican Super PAC, put in $5 million to ballot chase and got people knocking on doors and trying to get ballots and, you know, get people to fill out their... So, I mean, it was doable, right?
And so if you're talking about, you know, in districts like mine, the Latino population is lower, they're lower propensity voters, meaning that you have to make more connections.
You have to work harder.
Yeah, you do. You have to work harder. And it's not just going to be through TV and radio. It's not going to be through phone banking. It's going to be through, you know, going door to door, making sure people know, especially in a year like this where voting changed so much that, you know, it's about voter education. And I think that there's, if there was one thing that was it. You know, there's, you can argue about the messaging and everything like that. And Dave Wasserman was on last time with us and said that he thinks that Democrats need to get rid of the term or completely ban the term people of color, because he said that he didn't think that people wanted to be, you know, thought of that way as kind of like a group that's not just teachers and, you know, nurses and
people. How much do you think that is part of, and I'm not suggesting that it is, but there are those who suggest, and I won't ask you, I won't put you on the spot here, but a lot of people wonder, I mean, the message comes from the top. I'm not blaming Pelosi, but I mean, this leadership team has been in place since 2001 for the yeah. most part, right? I guess I don't remember when Hoyer beat Murtha, a race that Pelosi supported Murtha in, not Hoyer. But I just wonder, I think, let me put it this way. I wonder how the party will change in the post-Pelosi era. I don't know when that will be. It'll only be when she wants it to be.
Yep.
And I wonder if it will change. These things are cyclical, right? I mean, the electorate shifts based on a million different things. Not only the Latino vote, not only the Black vote or the union vote. I mean, just the vote, we have a dynamic electorate, which is good, but, it'll be interesting to see. 2022 will be super interesting, right?
Oh, yeah.
Because, I mean, Republicans smell the majority again.
Totally. And that often happens. I mean, that historically, that is what happens when you elect a president of one party, that the other party yep. gets the House the next time around.
This is the first time a president is going into the White House without complete control of Washington in a very long time.
Really?
We don't know how, because it is divided government, right? I mean, let's not be presumptive and say it's likely to be, it's like Republicans are likely, based on what we know, to keep the Senate. So we don't know if you'll still get that midterm bounce. But I mean, God, Republicans see it really, think it's really likely.
And you've got redistricting, and, you know, we don't know exactly how the census is going to play out. Like, there's so many unknowns. I was talking to Wasserman last time, and we may not know the districts. People may not know the districts that they're actually going to run in until, like, 6 months before the election. Like, it can be
crazy.
So, you know, I think that that's
And gonna, California, I imagine, is going to have a huge overhaul, right? There's always a huge overhaul, and I think and remember, this is the first time, I think, since 1998, and Wasserman would know this way better than me, that Republicans have netted a seat in California, which is, Kevin McCarthy has spent untold millions of dollars trying to make inroads in his home state, and he's been unsuccessful up until this year.
Well, I will take at least partial blame for that, but not full blame. this is really helpful. What else? What are your other observations? What about the new Q members of Congress? What are you thinking as a reporter? How that's going to, you know, affect
the QAnon members?
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, like I'll probably get myself in trouble here, but I'm less interested. First of all, we're going to cover. Well, I'm leaving Politico, so I'm not going to talk about what's next. But I will say that I'm going to be a journalist, so my interests remain the same.
You're not leaving the Hill. You're not leaving.
Well, not right. But like their impact on legislating is relatively minimal, right? They are not going to define they will say crazy shit.
Yeah.
Marjorie Taylor Greene today said, you know, masks are oppressive and whatever. And it's like, shut
up. Didn't you say my body, my choice? Like, yes. Oh my God. I just cannot handle how they're taking abortion messaging.
But, yeah. Right. Exactly. You know, she's already getting what she wants, right? She's getting the Capitol Hill press corps all worked up and all like bothered about it. And by the way, we should be, because these are like our leaders and they're federally elected officials who should be like not shitting on science, right?
Yeah.
Like they should be faithful to what, generally speaking, like what scientists tell us about public health.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I mean, these are people with extreme views, like really extreme views. QAnon is not a mainstream political thought, right? It's like they believe in like, it's not even worth getting into. Like,
it's
this
like
is
baby
not
eating.
Mainstream.
Like, it's crazy
right.
shit.
They,
yeah.
Well, they just believe that like Democrats are blood sucking pedophiles who are. So anyway, it's not even important to get into. So how do we deal with them? I don't know. They have to be held accountable for what they say and what they do. And McCarthy said the other day, give them a chance. I mean, I guess, I mean, we're going to give them a chance to say what they say. We're not going to make stuff up. We don't make stuff up about these people, but you know, you'll remember well that like when Rashida Tlaib said, impeach the fucker or impeach the motherfucker, whatever the fuck she said, like people got on her for that. And rightfully so, because you know, she had been in Congress, or maybe not rightfully so, I don't know, but like she had been in Congress for a day and she was saying she wanted to impeach him. So, you know, there's always kind of people on the, who get a lot of attention, but don't have a ton of impact in governing. And that's kind of my view on that. What else am I looking for? I'm looking for, you know, we're obviously super interested in what happens with the future of the Democratic leadership, as we've talked about, who positions themselves how for the post-Pelosi era, whenever that comes. I'm a little curious if AOC primaries Chuck Schumer.
I think a lot of us are real curious about that.
Yeah, I mean, she's got a lot of money. She's, I mean, the Schumer's just a really judicious campaigner and has been for a long time, and has represented the interests of New York. I'm not talking about policy wise, but it's just been really attentive to the interests of New York for a long time, meaning he's everywhere at all times. He's never taking a break. So how does that work? I don't know the answer to that. So those are the big kind of things that I'm looking at, I think. And I do wonder in the, I do wonder like how Joe Biden executes, who is going to be the, who's going to be his liaison to Capitol Hill? How is he going to use Kamala Harris? How is he going to, what does the makeup of that administration look like vis-a-vis legislating? Because, you know, he's somebody who believes in compromise, believes in legislating, and
he knows it. Like he knows.
He does. It. Although I think his knowledge of the modern day Congress is a bit overrated in the sense that the place has turned over a lot since he's been on Capitol Hill. And it's even turned over a lot since 2016 when he was last vice president. So, you know, those are my thoughts. And I think it's going to be really an interesting 2 years. It'll be interesting to watch.
So hopefully you'll join us again.
Happy to, anytime.
As we're watching all of this shake out. And good luck in your new adventure when you're ready to talk about it. We'll be here for it. Do you know who's going to write Playbook when you're gone?
I don't. I've not not part of those discussions.
Oh, yeah, I can imagine. You know, you usually get kind of ousted from those once you quit.
Listen, Playbook's been around for a long time, and I anticipate they will continue to be around for a long time. Politico, I was like the 50th person at Politico or something crazy like that, and now we're 500 something and like all across the planet. So you know, it's been a crazy ride. It's like almost the only place I've ever worked, pretty much. So I mean, I'm gonna be 35 and I was started when I was like 23 or something like that. So it's been a long, strange trip, but a cool, really great one. And I'm super appreciative for like the experience.
That's awesome. Well, I'm glad you'll still be around here and we'll catch up again.
Yeah. Thanks.
Thanks a lot. Talk to you later.
See ya. Bye.
Well, everyone, I hope that was informative and interesting to you. There's going to be a lot shaking out over the next 6 weeks. We're going to try and follow it as closely as possible, hoping to get some of the new members on here soon to tell us a little bit what it's like to go through the orientation right now. And also some of the members who are obviously coming back. So stay tuned and we'll talk to you next week. Have a good one.